When a pastor turns his pulpit over to a layperson, it's with a great responsibility. I consider it a sacred responsibility because I'm an ex-felon, and yet Doug gave me his pulpit today. I want to talk to you about hope that never surrenders. I want to talk to you about Jesus Christ and the love of God and the work of the Holy Spirit. To do that, I have to share a little bit about who I am and why I do this. I grew up in Southern California in a broken family. My father abused his kids. He used to beat my brother and I about every other night. I wanted to be a good kid, but when my mom divorced my dad, that was the best moment in my life. I wanted a dad. You know who I wanted to be my dad? I wanted Ronald Reagan. I'm going to be 70 this year, so we're going back a ways, but he had a program called 20 Mule Team Borax with in the desert, and the advice he gave, I thought, why couldn't I have a father like that? But I graduated from high school. My parents didn't really care about my brother and I, so when I graduated from high school, I graduated at the very top of the lower third of the class, okay? And when I got out of high school, I immediately went in the Navy. I joined the Navy because I wanted to be a diver for Jacques Cousteau. That was my big dream. My mom said that would never happen because I'm an American and I don't speak French and I have ADHD, DE, hypertension deficit disorder, deluxe edition. And if anybody else has that, it's not a disorder, it's a gift because you're never bored. But anyway, I joined the Navy. I became a Navy bomb disposal frogman. I worked with the Secret Service protecting foreign heads of state. I worked at the CIA. I did 4 tours to Vietnam. Never hurt anybody, never got hurt. I participated in military operations, top secret operations, and I loved it. And I threw it all away. See, I was learning to surf, and I had friends who were using marijuana. And when they weren't in the water surfing, they were using the marijuana on the beach, and my friends were using a drug. What did I start doing? Using a drug. In fact, one of them wanted me to help him sell it, and I said, no, Leroy, I don't want to be a drug dealer like you. He got really mad at me. He said, Steve, I'm not a drug dealer. A drug dealer is somebody out on the street selling drugs to strangers. He says, I don't do that. I only sell marijuana and just to my friends. What I'm doing is I'm helping my friends. When somebody's going to lie, who do they have to lie to first? They have to lie to themselves. Let's go a little bit deeper. They have to justify the telling of the lie to themselves. They have to justify it, and as they lie, it becomes a part of their life. I started to help him. I got caught with 2 ounces of marijuana, and it ended a 14-year naval career that I loved. It was my fault. It was gone. What it led to was far worse. Rather than tell you, I have a short video. This is by NBC News. And it tells my story faster than I could ever share it with you. So please, if you're ready, hit play.
Ten feet down in the blue water of the South Pacific, Steve Arrington is that close to disaster. And he's as happy as a man can be. Eye to eye with a great white shark, he's a man redeemed.
I'm a very lucky person. What I've been through, I've experienced something that a lot of people don't get the chance to do. And because I've seen the shadowed side of the world, it makes me appreciate the light that's out there.
Once upon a time, Steve Arrington was a young Navy golden boy, a frogman, a bomb disposal expert, officer material. Then one day he was caught selling marijuana, and he was out of the Navy and on the beach, and fell into the drug business. Was drawn like a fly to the web, found himself running cocaine for the Medellin cartel. He was faced with a choice, drive the car with the coke inside or die. And so began his brief brush with notoriety as a footnote in a worldwide publicity frenzy.
The conspiracy was allegedly hatched between the auto tycoon and 2 other men.
Arrington was arrested in Los Angeles by agents closing in on the John DeLorean case.
A man leaped out of the darkness as he opens the door, and he jams a .38 special alongside my head, and he told me, move and die. And I thought it was a ripoff, and I thought I was about to die. And the next words that he said were the greatest words I've ever heard in my life. He said, DEA, federal agent, you're under arrest. Suddenly, I felt a burden had been lifted from my shoulders. I wasn't arrested. I was saved.
He was sentenced to 5 years in a federal penitentiary. Arrington's life had hit bottom.
You live in a cell like this. The cell is from here to here. You can stretch your arms out and touch both walls. I knew that I had to live with this, and I had a goal. I wanted to do things like this.
But inside, he made himself a promise that no kid would ever come to a place like this if Arrington could prevent it. And now, with missionary zeal, he talks to students, scouts, anybody who will listen about the ugly world on the wrong side of the law.
Prison is about fear. Everybody's afraid. The really big, gnarly, bad-looking dude, he's afraid. And people get murdered. Men get raped by men. You know, they don't need a reason for somebody to kill you in prison. Somebody can have you killed for 2 cartons of cigarettes in prison. 2 cartons of cigarettes, value of somebody's life in prison.
Do they listen? Yes, enthralled.
Was it easy starting it over?
Okay, was it easy starting my life over? Very good question. I walk up, or somebody's going to hire me, let's say, I walk up and I say, I'm an ex-felon. Do they want to hire me? Do you want to have me living next door? Do you want me dating your sister? Yes or no?
No.
No, it's a definite no.
Until he asked the Cousteau Society, which decided that an old Navy frogman who had seen the worst of man would be perfect to study the world of sharks. This month he is in the South Pacific, staring down jaws and, as we say, redeemed.
I call this slide freedom. This is the type of things I thought about from my jail cell.
Keith Morrison, NBC News, Los Angeles.
I'm an ex-felon. I went to prison. I deserved to go to prison. Nobody wakes up one morning and says, you know what? I think I'm going to be a criminal and I'm going to spend most of my life in prison. What happens is he makes small choices, something that takes him out of the light and into the darkness. When I talk to kids, I tell them that we're social creatures. We like to do things together. If I'm doing something good, I want to involve my friends, my family. Well, the other side of the coin is when somebody's doing something wrong, they also try to involve their friends. And what they see is they see their friend, they don't see that dark, dark, scary world that's on the other side of them. The criminal dance leads to a drain. And sometimes there's no coming back. For me, I'm not going to tell you my whole story, because I want to talk about Jesus Christ. I'm a writer. I write books. You can get my whole story there. What I want to talk to you is about hope that never surrenders. Hope that never surrenders. But in a nutshell, what happened is I went to a man who was once a father figure for me, a mentor. And he was an aviation engineering genius, and he lost all of his money in a contentious divorce. And his companies were leveraged, and he lost it all. And 7 years later, when I see him, I haven't seen him for 7 years. He tells me that he's a multimillionaire again and that he's always looked at me upon me like one of his sons, and he wanted me to come to work for him as a pilot and as a right-hand man. And I thought it was a legitimate job. What I didn't know is he had become the number one cocaine smuggler on the west coast of the United States. He was the number one smuggler for the Medellin drug cartel. When he revealed what he was doing and he told me to want me to co-pilot a plane to Colombia, I refused. As court record, I refused. And then they brought out the guns and they said, it's really simple. It's called silver or lead. Get in the plane or take a bullet in the head. And as a coward, I got in the plane. And I did something I never should have done. Came back with 650 pounds of cocaine in an airplane. And then they ordered me to drive a car from Florida to California full of cocaine. I don't want to do this, but I did. And when I got in that car, it was in Florida, and it was a dark parking lot, and there was all these Colombians with guns. And as I get in this car, I'm scared to death. I just wasn't sure what I could do to get out. And as I start to drive the car away, I just want to relax. And so I turned on the radio. I wanted some music. And if we can show the first image, please. Instead of music, what I heard on the radio was Ronald Reagan announcing the war on drugs. October the 14th, 1982, he announces the war on drugs. War on who? Me. And I knew right then and there that I could not deliver that car. Instead of delivering the car, I abandoned it. I abandoned that car. You can go back to me if you like with it, because there'll be a moment for the next slide. As I'm driving the car across the United States, I just wanted out. And I didn't know how to get out without being killed. And so instead of delivering the car with $28 million of the cocaine in it, I abandoned it at an airport parking lot. I walked away. I called my boss up. I said, I quit. He said, you bring that car here or we'll go through your family like a chainsaw. I refused to take the car. I went to where he was at, to the Marriott Hotel on Century Boulevard by LAX. And I walked into the lobby. When he came down, he said, where's the car? And I said, I'll give you the keys, but I'm walking away. And he goes, no, you're not. And he snapped his fingers, and two men walked up on either side of me, and they had guns right under the jacket. And he said, these are mafia hitmen, no games. And he told them, take me to the drug car and bring back the cocaine. Did he say, bring back the idiot? No, these guys are going to kill me. I know it. We get to the drug car. I'm just looking for my chance to run. And as they're making sure they're checking the cocaine, I start to back away. And suddenly I see a dozen men come running out of the darkness with rifles, pistols, and shotguns. And I think it's a drug gang and it's a ripoff and I'm about to die. And one of them jams a pistol alongside my head and yells, move and die. Another one jams a shotgun against my chest. He says, put your hands up. What do you do? Move and die. Put your hands up. What do you do? I put my hands halfway up on the steering wheel. They were shaking. And then the guy with the handgun yelled the greatest words he could have yelled. He yelled, federal agents, dirt bag, you're under arrest. What went through my heart and soul was incredible relief. I wasn't arrested. I was saved from a life that was out of control. Where am I going? I'm going to prison. Okay, back to the PowerPoint, please. I have the cover of the Los Angeles Times the day after I was arrested. And it shows on the front page, John DeLorean, my new co-defendant. I went from 2 ounces of marijuana that ruined a naval career to 650 pounds of cocaine, to driving a car $28 million of the cocaine in it, to becoming a co-defendant of what has been called the drug trial of the century. Wow. When I mess up, I don't play games. Okay? I did not expect this. I had no idea. Look who's on the front cover. Who did I want to be associated with, DeLorean or Ronald Reagan? See, Ronald Reagan has his arms open. See that? This is the newspaper from the next day. There I am with Morgan Hetrick, the man I worked for. I'm going to tell my story quickly, if you don't mind. I'll slow it down for one part. I became the inmate orderly. I cleaned the cell block. And a few months after I was arrested, there was a fight over television. And a young man who changed the channel on an older man, he had his back to him. The older man, there was a mop bucket with a ringer. And the older man pulled the ringer out and he ran it behind the kid and he swung it and he hit him in the back of the head and fractured his skull. And blood went everywhere. And then they brought me out, they locked down the cell block to clean up the blood. And it was a lot of blood. And our prison was built before World War II, so it was an old prison. And as I wheeled this mop bucket full of water and blood, but it looked like all blood to me, back to the mop bucket room, deep sink room, I opened it, little room, yellow dirty light, moldy, crusty, cracked, stained sink. And I take this beautiful red blood and I pour it down the drain. And I saw hair in the drain. And I realized right there that I was going to die in prison. Because you see, they had told me I was facing 144 years to life because it was ongoing criminal enterprise with the RICO Act and that I was going to be in prison for the rest of my life if I did not cooperate. I went back to my cell and I got on my bunk and I remembered something. As kids, we went to church a few times, just a few times. We went on Christmas and Easter, every Christmas and Easter for 2 years straight. Every Christmas, every Easter, 2 years straight. That was my Christian experience as a kid. But I remember reading that the blood will set you free, and I now knew a lot about blood. And at 2 o'clock in the morning in a prison cell, I got down on my knees, and I began to pray. I did not expect my prayer to get answered. It did. Here's what I prayed. Father, I am so sorry. I have thrown my life away. Society has locked me up. Friends have turned their backs on me. But what about you, Father? Are you there for a sinner like me, a felon in a prison cell? And suddenly this incredible feeling flushed through me. Not a word. An incredible feeling. And if it was a word, the word was always. Father, are you there for a sinner like me, a felon in a prison cell? Always. And it changed my life in a heartbeat. Now, when I say that, it did not take away my problems. I'm still facing 144 years in prison. Prison is a very scary place to be. It didn't take away my guilt. What it took away was the tragedy of the moment. And what it left in its place was the wonder that God still loved me. God still loved me. And my life was forever changed. It was 10 months before I could go before the judge and plead guilty, because I was planning on pleading guilty all along. I refused to testify against anybody but myself. I testified against me. And when I went before the judge, I had met with a probation officer, and she asked me, I told her that I was guilty, I deserved this, but I'm a Christian now, and whatever's coming at me, I have hope that can never surrender, so I can handle it. But she says, how much time do you think you should get? And I said, 5 years. And she said, what? I said, 5 years. She said, well, that's a serious sentence. And I said, well, look, I deserve to be punished. I did it. No excuses. I did it. I deserve to be punished. And 5 years is enough, plenty of time to punish me, but it's not enough time to change who I am. And it won't take my hope away. So I'm hoping for 5 years. And then I went before the judge, and people had written letters. The prosecutor did his arguments. The defense did their arguments. And I got up before the judge, and I told him something. It's all documented. That I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done it, but I did. And that I want to do nothing but good for the rest of my life. And after you sentence me, when I get out of prison, I want to talk to young people about choices. That's what I want to do. And the judge sentenced me for I had two counts against me at that point. For the first count, he gave me 5 years. For the second count, he gave me 5 years, and he paused, and he said, your sentence will run concurrently. It means I got my 5 years. Do you understand? I can do this because it's what I asked for. It's what I asked for. I was a Christian at this point in time, and I will admit that I did do a prayer or two asking God to let me out of prison. But then I had my Bible open. I just sat down and I just opened it, and I'm thinking about that. I would really love to be let out of prison. And I was in Romans 5, 3-5, and it talks right there about tribulation leading to building of character, and it leads to hope because it brings us closer to God. Where we learn about life is not on the mountaintops, but in the valleys of depression. And so I decided to be an honor inmate, the best inmate they ever had. Within 2 months of my being released into general population, I was in the honor dorm. Within 2 months. Nobody heard of that before. It was amazing. I always wanted to be a good guy. I decided in prison, the Department of Corrections, that's what I need. I'm going to partner with the Department of Corrections to become a better person. And then they sent me early to an honor camp. And when I got to the honor camp, I went to an honor camp in the desert, in the Mojave Desert. And this prison camp had a fire crew. And I really wanted to be an inmate fireman. And I told my counselor that I'd like to be on the fire crew because I want to do nothing but good. And wouldn't that be a nice thing to do good as an inmate fireman? And he said, no, 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 no. To be on the fire crew, you have to be in the honor dorm. That means you have to be here for 18 months to prove who you are. And only then can you join the fire crew because the fire crew is a fire truck. In fact, they have a couple fire trucks and they get to leave the prison. So you cannot be an inmate fireman. You are a plumber. I didn't give up. I prayed, and then I went to see the safety officer, and please, if you're looking for work, listen to what I'm saying. I went to the safety officer, and I said, sir, I deserve to be here. I did it. I'm trying to change who I am. For the rest of my life, I'm going to be a Christian, I'm going to serve God, and I'm only going to do good work as best I can, as best I can. And I want to be an inmate fireman more than anything. I'll be the best inmate fireman you ever had. When I was in the Navy, I was the chief of Explosive Ordnance Disposal, Mobile Unit 1, Team 11. I was in charge of a bomb disposal team. I drove a fire truck, red light, I drove a bomb disposal truck, red light and siren to keep stop bombs from blowing up. I'm committed. I'm motivated. I'll be the first one here every day. I'll be the last one to leave. I will always arrive with a smile on my face. I will polish the truck. I'll polish the toilet. I'll fix the truck. I'll fix the toilet. I will get along with everybody, and during times of danger, I will be the first one in. And 1 week later, I was an inmate fireman. You know, I can't, go ahead and go to the slides, please. How many of you would like to drive a fire truck like that? We had a 1948 Mack. It didn't look as nice as that one did, but we had a 1948 Mack. And when I joined the fire crew, I was with them for 2 months. And then the chief engineer, he got released from prison. And as he walks, he shakes hands with each of the firemen. And then as he walks away, the six of his firemen are standing there. And the senior fireman, he picks up the chief engineer's helmet. He picks up the chief engineer's helmet. And he takes it, come back to me, okay, he takes the chief engineer's helmet, and he walks all the way down the line from the senior firefighters to the most junior firefighter, and he hangs this on my peg. The crew voted for who led them. And I became chief engineer of an inmate fire crew and left the prison 17 times, driving a fire truck, red light and siren, all the excitement of a prison escape, but we were about saving lives. Isn't this amazing? I want to show you a few more images about being an inmate firefighter. There's another shot at the truck. That's the engineer station. That's where I would stand. And this is what most inmates know. This is what most inmates know. This is life in prison. God gave me an incredible gift. He clothed me with firefighter turnouts. When you see firefighters, what do you see? Give me a name for it. Begins with an H, ends with an O, has an E and an R in it. Heroes. I mean, firefighters are true heroes, emergency responders. And you never know what you're going to respond to. This is me in prison. I'm the one without the blurred face because my fire crew doesn't really want you to know who they were. Okay? What an amazing thing to be an inmate fireman. The walk of courage, of going in. When other people are running away, you're going in. And this is a famous firefighter. Because at 9/11, when people were dying and people were running, he was going in. You know, Jack, where are you at? Hello, Jack. Are you way back there? Okay, I need you to know how important this gift that God gave to me truly was. Imagine this. You leave the sanctuary. You're going to maybe have lunch here. Go ahead. You know how to do it. Figure it out. Or he hasn't done it yet, but he's going about to learn how to do it. You get on your street, and as you pull up, the house next door is on fire. There's a fire going on. There is fire coming out the roof. There is smoke coming out the windows. The mother is in the front of the yard going, "Help, help, my children are in there. My babies are in there. Somebody help me." And if any of you go in there, if any of you try this, you will never get in there in time. Gonna just, wait. Cool. Okay. And then suddenly, dress quick. We haven't run a time limit. Suddenly, the fire truck comes in. You hear the fire truck coming down the street. It stops, and the fire crew jumps down from the fire truck, and they start getting all the gear ready, and the chief engineer... Does your mom dress you?
Huh?
Okay. Like this? Like this? Under the arm? You're already standing tall. Doesn't he look good? Didn't he just change from the person you've always known? Okay. You just got out of a fire truck. There's a house right there. It's on fire. You are backed up by a crew who are completely motivated and trained. And there are little children. Hear them crying? There's little kids in there. And what do little kids do when they're in a fire?
They cry.
What else do they do? There's smoke. It's scary. They hide. Okay. They hide. They hide in the closet. They hide under the bed. It takes somebody who's willing to what? Will you risk your life to go in there?
Yeah.
Now, I'm not asking you lightly. If you wear this uniform as a firefighter, would you put your life on the line?
Yeah.
I love the spirit. Isn't it wonderful?
Yeah.
Okay. This is, yeah. Thank you. How heavy is that jacket?
Pretty heavy.
So you really know you're wearing something?
Yeah.
Okay. It's going to be, you can leave it right there. And Jack, you did a perfect, tell him thank you. Okay. That jacket has weight. It is very heavy. After the service, pick it up, put it on. Feel what it's like. It has weight. You cannot put that jacket on and not become a person of meaning and purpose. You cannot put that jacket on unless you are willing to put your life on the line. I wanted to do good work. What better gift could God have given me in prison than to make me chief engineer of an inmate fire crew? What could he have done? And you never know what you're going to get as a firefighter. You never know what's going to happen. 6 miles from the prison camp, an Air Force plane crashed. We didn't know what we had. We just knew we had a plane on the ground, and it was being circled by other aircraft, an Air Force fighter. And I thought it was an Air Force B-52 bomber, because I have to assume the worst case situation has got to be the B-52. I called San Bernardino Command, Inmate Engine 52 responding, down military aircraft, possibly a B-52. Need all the help you can get. It wasn't the B-52. It was the first stealth bomber, the first supersonic B-1A-4 aircraft to crash. This is it. It was the most advanced aircraft in the American inventory, and it went down 6 miles from Boron Prison Camp in the open rugged desert. And in this plane, the whole crew goes out in a capsule. The whole crew. You can come back to me now instead of the PowerPoint. The whole crew goes out in a capsule. And when I saw it, I didn't know it was that plane. All I know is I'm responding with a fire truck. I'm driving it off-road, a 1965 Ford fire truck. I'm driving it off-road, and finally we get to the crash site, and I see the airplane burning here, and less than maybe 150 yards away, there's a capsule, and that's how I knew it was the B-1A, because that was the only aircraft where the whole crew went out in a capsule, and the door was closed. That meant they were in trouble, that they needed help. And I took our fire truck, and I went. And as I went alongside of it, two men jumped off the back, and then I put the fire truck into a slide to try to knock back the fire, because the fire is coming for it. And then we just pushed the fire away from the capsule, and two helicopters landed as we got the doors open. We got two men out alive. One was already dead. The pilot was already dead. We got two men out alive. And then I saw a dozen helicopters. It was like an airhead in Vietnam, an airhead being an assault. And there came in three diamonds of four helicopters each, really low over the desert, rushing at us full speed. And they start to settle around us in dust clouds, and Air Force men jumping out with rifles. And this one gunny sergeant, he ran up to me, and I'm standing there with a helmet that says Chief on it. And he immediately deferred to me, and he goes, Chief, what do you want us to do? And I said, help me contain the fire. Get the shovels off the truck. We're not trying to put any fires out. We're just going to protect the capsule. And for 20 minutes, I was in charge of the top secret site for the crash of the B-1A bomber in May of 1984 as an inmate. An Air Force officer flew in, and he walked up to me, and he goes, where'd you guys come from? And I'm going, Boron Prison Camp. He says, you're inmates? You can't be here. This is a top secret site. I said, sir, if we weren't here, who would have saved your crew of your B-1A? He said, what makes you think it's a B-1A? I said, come on, I'm a pilot. That's a B-1A bomber. He said, that's top secret. You can't tell anybody. I just got done putting it out over the radio. They pulled me off the fire crew for that. Later on, they put me back on. But then I got out of prison. And I was scared to death because I wasn't sure what I was going to become. What was going to happen to me when I got out of prison? I'm not going to be a chief anymore, except for maybe at a 7-Eleven of a mop and a bucket. And so when I got out, I was told to go see my parole officer. And he said, Arrington, I want you to go apply for a job at the College of Oceaneering. I said, what? He said, the College of Oceaneering. He said, you know what that is? I go, yeah, you're like, yeah, I know, but do you think they'd hire me? He goes, no, but you can try. And so I went to the College of Oceaneering. And the College of Oceaneering is the number one commercial diving school in Southern California. And I had been talking about it when I was in prison. I remember talking about it to highway patrolmen. because I'd be out there responding to an accident, saving lives, and then we'd have to wait for the helicopter or something like that, or the scene to be cleaned up, and I would visit with the highway patrolman. And I remember telling one, yeah, I would like to be an instructor at the College of Oceaneering because I have the background. I'm a scuba instructor. I'm a CPR instructor. I'm a first aid instructor. I'm a hyperbaric chamber supervisor. I have the background. I could do that job. But he said, do you think they hire you? And I said, I don't know. It's a co-ed college, and I'm just out of prison. I don't think so. And so I go to the College of Oceaneering like I was told to do, and I met Tom Mix, the air diving supervisor, and I told him my story and asked him if he wanted to hire me, and he said, nope. I said, do you know anybody who might like to hire someone like me? He goes, nope. He said, but I liked your story, and I want to shake your hand. And so when I put my hand out, he dropped a set of keys in it. And I said, what are these keys? He said, the keys to the college. I go, why are you giving me keys to the college? He says, you're our newest instructor. I said, I thought you weren't hiring. He said, I'm not. I hired you yesterday. How could you hire me yesterday? Because I have been getting letters, and the college has been getting letters from highway patrolmen and other law enforcement officers, from prison guards, of all these people said that this is where you want to work, and they said that I could really work out here and that they had to give me a shot, or if you didn't, you would get tickets if you tried to drive across the desert. And so here I am. Go ahead and go to the images, please. Let me see which one's up there. Okay, so here I am, 3 days out of prison. Do I look like a scary criminal there? Do I look like a scary criminal now? I have always been me, and you will always be you. But if you want to know true wonder and joy in life, then you give who you are, you surrender yourself to Jesus Christ. You do this, and it will change your life like you can't believe. And if you do his work, you share his work, you do things to help people, things are going to happen like you can't believe. Now, what did I tell the judge I wanted to do? I wanted to talk to kids. Guess how many I talked to? Almost none, because I was too ashamed. I was too ashamed to go to a principal at a school and say, hey, I just got out of prison for drug smuggling. I want to talk to the kids about drugs. What do you think, huh? Not going to happen. And I prayed about it. Father, help me. And then something happened. I was the school medic because I had that medical background. And so I took care of emergencies. And one of the students cheated on a project underwater at a depth of about 50 feet. He cheated on a project. The project weighed around 300 pounds. And he made it unstable because he was cheating for a better time. And it fell on him. Now that's a commercial diver standing next to me. He had all that gear on. It fell on him. It drove him face down into the mud and pinned him. And in his panic, he unhooked the helmet. And he screamed. And then they heard the water. And then he died. He was trapped underwater for over 8.5 minutes. This is a commercial diving college. There are legal books, record keeping that we do. Everything is documented. This was completely documented by several sources. He was trapped underwater without air for over 8.5 minutes. When they got him to the surface, he was a corpse. He was purple from too much CO2, no oxygen. His eyes were fixed and staring. He was flaccid. As we laid him down on the deck, water flowed out of his mouth. But I had been a CPR instructor for 14 years, and my job was to do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and CPR. And as I got down to do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on this young man, I am praying for all I'm worth, Father, let it be your breath, not mine. It's too late for me. It's never too late for you. We did CPR for 20 minutes before the fire department arrived and transported the boy away. And we knew he was gone. And the next day, I was teaching in a classroom when the air diving supervisor ran in and yelled, he woke up. He was in hyperbarics at the North Ridge Hyperbaric Facility, and because he had been scientifically at a depth of 50 feet, high partial pressure of oxygen, low partial pressure of carbon dioxide, cold water slowing down the metabolism, they said that's why he made it. No, it's not. He made it because God used my breath to save his life. And I knew right then and there that if God could use my breath to save that boy's life, that I should be going to the principals of the school and saying, look, I'm an ex-felon. I went to prison and I deserved it. And I don't want other kids to go, and I don't want to glorify what I did wrong. What I want to do is I want to help kids to make right choices. Now, the first 20 schools I went to said no. But you see, I had something. I had this document. is from the fire department. This is an award from Los Angeles Fire Department for my saving that boy's life. Now, I want you to see the tie-in. Do you see the tie-in? Firefighter in prison. Now firefighters give me an award. You know what? I still had a big issue. I had Ronald Reagan issues still. I mean, I really did. I mean, I saw him on the front page of the paper when I got arrested. I felt that I had failed this man. But, you know, the Red Cross got really super excited. They gave me their highest award for life-saving. One of their instructors for over 14 years has saved the life of a kid. They wanted to make a big deal out of this, so they did. They gave me their highest award for life-saving, and it was signed by President Ronald Reagan. God knows what you need in life. He knows what's going to take you to the next step. He knows. He wants to help you to surrender. Because that's what you have to do. You need to renew the Holy Spirit. You need to ask the Spirit into you every single day. Because we sin every single day. And so we got to keep on asking. And we got to keep on having him come in to us to change who we are and what we are. And so I started going to schools, talking to kids about how do you feel when you do something good. Let me ask you, how do you feel when you do something good? Feel good. How do you feel when you do something bad? Then why do we do the bad? Fiji water, really? Fiji? Huh? Huh? Thank you. When we do things that are bad, we feel bad. When we do things that are good, we feel good. Why do we do the bad? It's called original sin. We sin. We fall short. We were told that if somebody sins against us, we're to forgive them, what, 7 times? No, 70 times 7 times. Let me ask you from a different way. How many times would you like God to be willing to forgive you? I know he's forgiven me many, many, many thousands of times already. He never gives up on us. I have been going to schools and speaking to schools, to kids about drug choices now for over 20 years. I've done over 3,500 public school assemblies in 49 states. Sacramento, 12 years ago, ranked me as the number one anti-drug speaker and education motivational speaker in the nation. In the county. Last Friday afternoon, I was up in Portela speaking to 5th and 6th graders about life, about choices. What are the two words I'm not allowed to say in a public school? I can talk about God. I can't talk about Jesus Christ. I can't talk about Jesus Christ. But what I can share is what Jesus Christ would want them to know. And that's exactly what I do. When I'm up there, when I'm speaking in public schools, I've now, in the last couple of months, spoken in schools, public schools in 5 counties around here. If anybody wants me to speak in one of your public schools, remember my webpage. My webpage is Drugs Bite. Drugs Bite. DrugsBite.com. You want me to speak in a public school? If you want me to come speak at one of your churches, or if you know a church you'd like me to go to, that's DreamMachineFoundation.com. Why is it? It's a nonprofit. Why is it .com? Because when I started it 22 years ago, .org wasn't known. I didn't even know about it, so I went with .com. After working at the College of Oceaneering for almost 2 years, I wanted more in life. I was still on probation. I was teaching at a college. I had a beautiful life, but I felt that I needed to do more. And a man came through our school to learn hyperbaric medicine, to refresh it. He was a chief diver for Captain Jacques Cousteau. Can you imagine how excited I was to meet him? And he sat in my classroom for five days. And I talked to the kids, and when he left, I said, Don, if you ever need a diver, give me a call. And so a few weeks go by, and the phone on the pier rings. And I run down, and I pick up the phone, and I go, hello? And an oddly familiar voice says, is Steve Arrington there? And I go, this is Steve. He goes, Steve, it's Don Santee. I go, hi, Don. He said, Steve, still interested in working for the Cousteau Society? I said, absolutely. He said, well, give notice. I need you as soon as you can get here. Jean-Michel Cousteau says I need to clone myself. You're coming up here, and your title is chief diver, expedition leader. And I went off on a 5.5 year odyssey of diving with whales and dolphins and great white sharks. You know, what's amazing about this is this was another gift from God, okay? And when God gives you a gift, he always has a purpose. You know, we often ask for things for what we want. You know, give me what I want. But what we really should be asking for is, what can I do for you, Father? How can I help my fellow man? And so when I got this phone call that I was going to get to be a chief diver for the expedition, an expedition leader for the Cousteau Society, I was totally amazed. Now, I want you to go back to when I first arrived in prison. When I first arrived in prison, I was facing 144 years to life in prison. I had been the chief of a bomb disposal team, but not anymore. I'll never be chief again. And then in prison, I become chief engineer of an inmate fire crew. You see how God brought that back into my life? Now, there's something that you need to know. I already mentioned it. My team, each team specializes. My team specialized in military aircraft and aircraft carriers. When I led the response for the crash of the B-1A bomber, I was the most qualified person on that site to deal with it as an inmate. And God gave me that. He gave me that. And then, when I got out of prison, I'm no longer a chief. I think I'm maybe pushing a broom. And I wind up at the College of Oceaneering, and I get this award for life-saving, which helped me realize who I was as a human being and to have hope that never surrendered. And then I get a call from the Cousteau Society as to become a chief diver and expedition leader, and I can't go anywhere because I'm on parole. So I called up my prosecutor. Are you ready for this? My prosecutor and I had become friends. Remember the NBC footage? And I showed talking to the Boy Scout troop? That was my prosecutor's Boy Scout troop. And if you see that footage again, you will see a man standing there in shorts. That's the prosecutor in the John DeLorean drug trial. And I spoke to his troop of kids. And these miracles just kept coming because he argued to get me off of special parole so that I could travel the world with the Cousteau Society. And what this has done is it's given me whales and dolphins and sharks to talk to kids about to capture their attention. And then I can share about about crazy FBI men and wacko guards and, mean inmates. I can talk to them about the more serious lessons of life. You see, God gave me all this to do his work. To do his work. Whatever is going on in your life, if you give it to Jesus Christ, if you completely surrender, and I do mean surrender. You see, God gave us free will. We make choices. We have to choose. When you surrender to God, you're allowing him to begin to change who you are. And I don't know how he's going to change you, because what do we know? We're just human beings. But he will make opportunities for you. After 5.5 years with the Cousteaus of diving with whales and dolphins and sharks, I wanted to speak full-time to kids. That's what I wanted to do. I've now done 3,500 public school assemblies. Spoken in hundreds of churches. Spoken to audiences up to 10,000 people with kids. Because this is the toughest time ever in America to be a young person growing up. This is the toughest time ever in America to be a kid growing up. If you don't know this, you should. I'm going to share it with you right now. The number one killer in the United States for children 10 years old, to adults 45 years old, is unintentional death. Unintentional death. They used to call it death by accident, accidental death. Now they call it unintentional death. You know why? The number one cause of unintentional death, the number one cause of unintentional death is drug overdose for 10 years old to 35 to 45 year olds. The number two cause of death in the United States for children 10 years old to young adults 35 is suicide. It's suicide. The number three cause of death for children 15 to young adults 25 is homicide. That's why I call it Battlefield America. We are fighting a war right here, and it's families on the front line, and there is a place for you in it to help. With the divorce rate, with families split up, with grandma and grandpa living in one state, aunts and uncles in another state, what kids need is love. They're always wondering, what is going to change it for kids? They spell love. They spell time. They spell love, T-I-M-E. Spend time with them. Grandparents, connect with your grandchildren. Because you are the fonts of wisdom that these kids absolutely need in their lives. They need you. You are required. It used to be that's how we raise kids. And now so many kids in schools are apathetic. They don't have hope. Mentor. Get involved as a church. You know, when I got that letter, that award from the Red Cross, signed by Ronald Reagan, you know, it felt like a presidential pardon for me. It felt like a presidential pardon. But 9 years ago, I filled out the paperwork for a real pardon. I didn't hire an attorney to fill it out for me. I didn't make contributions to a political party. I just filled out the paperwork and sent it in. And then they sent it back and said, hey, fill in the spots we've marked. And I sent it back in. And when I spoke at churches and schools and such, people would write letters to President Bush. Nothing happened. Then they wrote them to President Obama, and years go by and nothing happens. And then I found out that there was a secret memorandum that was leaked. And it was where President Obama had sent out a memorandum to the Department of Justice saying, I do not want any applications for a presidential pardon to cross my desk by anybody who was a serious drug felon. You know what the name of my case was? Which, because of John DeLorean? The drug trial of the century. I called up the prosecutor, and I said, what do you think the chances of me getting a pardon are? He says, none. He used other words, but he said, none. And I talked to my judge, and I said, I was applying for a pardon. He says, let me be the number one person to recommend you. And he wrote a letter for me for a pardon. And time goes on, and time goes on. And then it's the last days in office. And I just think, I'm never going to get a presidential pardon. I've been pardoned by God, but I'll never be pardoned by my country. And you see, I'm a patriot. I wanted to serve my country. I volunteered during the Vietnam War. I did four tours in Vietnam. I'm a patriot. I always wanted to be a good person. 2 ounces of marijuana destroyed my life. Why can't I have my life back? Why can't I be a citizen like you? And then on January the 17th last year, my phone rang, and I picked it up, and it said Washington, D.C. on it. And I've been fooled before, because every time it's from Washington, D.C., it's a marketing call. But I picked it up, and I said, this is Steve Arrington. And it said, Stephen, my name is so-and-so, and I'm attorney at the Presidential Pardon Office. In fact, I've been the one who's been handling your case for 8 years. I know all about you. I need to tell you something. You can't talk about this. Don't let people know. But right now, President Obama is signing a full and unconditional pardon for you. And here it is on the screen. And this is the first time in a church I've ever been able to show this and not cry. Because the wounds go deep. And only God can reach down so far and make you right again. And then, on his last day in office, President Obama took the time to write me a letter congratulating me. That's his signature. I'm a person again. I'm a citizen of the United States. I can run for sheriff if I want to. I teased the sheriff, I said, do that. He goes, no, you're not. Has God done enough with me? No, because I'm still here. In Fiji, we have saved hundreds of lives. I don't know how many. Roger Lutz, our project manager, is sitting right there. I don't know how many lives we've saved. I really don't know how many people we have treated for free, medical and dental. I'm guessing around 35,000. Is that number out of, is that somewhere, and you would buy that, Roger, as our project manager? He's nodding. He doesn't always agree with me. It's rare. I want to do good with the rest of my life. I want you to do good with the rest of your life. In a moment, I'm going to close with prayer. Before I do, I need to say this, is our work in Fiji, I'm a faith ministry. I'm not here at any charge whatsoever. That's how I run my ministry. I'm going to be back tonight at 7 o'clock shark. I once landed in the water 6 feet from a 17 and a half foot long great white shark. That's me coming up in a moment in the world's first all plastic shark cage. That's me. If you come back tonight, you will have a great time. I will talk about whales and dolphins and sharks. I will share about Fiji. If you've been wanting to bring a visitor to this church and have them come back and with a really positive feeling, let it be tonight at 7 o'clock shark. I will be here, okay? But I get to take an offering tonight, but I'm not going to take one this morning. If you want to help the foundation and our work in Fiji, the round table on your way out, there'll be a basket there. If you want me to speak at your schools, it's drugsbite.com. If you want to know more about Fiji and the work we're doing in the South Pacific, you want to join us for a mission work, you want to come down to Fiji, you will love it. They love people. They used to be cannibals. So they love people. They make jokes. They make jokes about it. Oh, I'd love to have you over for lunch. In all sincerity, God has blessed me more than I ever deserved. I have a wife and children. Life is wonderful. Join me in closing prayer. Dear Father, Father, you are incredible. You know hope is needed by everybody here, and you want to share it with us. All we have to do is ask for it. All we have to do is surrender. All we have to do is open up our hearts and our souls and invite you in, and our lives will be ever changed. And if we keep a close walk with you, wow, the wonders that can happen. And Father, I ask a special blessing on every person in this church, everybody watching right now, that each and every single one of us has the chance to do something good for somebody else every day of the rest of their lives. And not just to do good in a nameless way, but to name why we're doing the good. We're doing the good in the name of Jesus Christ, because he will change their life forever. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.